Each year, about 3,000 undocumented students graduate from high schools in Georgia, but then they're denied admission to college because Georgia, along with South Carolina and Alabama, has imposed a ban on allowing them into some of their public colleges. In an article called American Studies, Jonathan Blitzer, a contributing writer for The New Yorker, writes about an underground university in Atlanta that's helping these undocumented students pursue college educations despite the ban. It's in the May 22nd issue of The New Yorker, and I'm very pleased it has brought Jonathan Blitzer back to our show. Welcome back.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
When did you first meet Melissa and Ashley, the twin sisters that you profile in this piece?
I spoke to Melissa and Ashley a number of times on the phone over the course of the end of the summer and early fall of 2016, and then went down to meet them in November this past year.
Are they identical twins?
They're identical twins.
But they don't have names that I would associate with a Mexican background.
Their first names. Yeah. Well, in some ways, I mean, they've really grown up in the U.S. I mean, they came to the U.S. when they were 6 years old, and they even speak. They have a sort of a slight sort of Georgia area twang in their voice. I mean, they identify as much as Americans as they ever would as Mexicans, probably much more so as Americans.
Were they very similar, as some twins are?
Very similar. I mean, in almost every sense. I mean, very smart, very intellectually curious, both loved art, had the same friends in high school, the same sorts of interests. They were very, very close and remain so.
What college were they hoping to go to?
Initially, they hoped to go to the University of Georgia. It's the state's flagship university. Most of their friends from high school went there.
And what happened when they try to fill out the online college application?
They start to fill out the application, and they notice that when they try to click to the second page of the application, they can't do it. So they call the admissions office at the University of Georgia to ask. They actually think at first that there might be a problem with the website, that maybe the website had crashed. And the receptionist says to them, well, what did you put down for your citizenship status? And because their citizenship status was at the time uncertain, they came here initially legally, but their family had never received their documentation. They couldn't say that they were citizens. And as a result, they couldn't click through this application. And that's how they found out about a policy that existed in the state that banned undocumented students from going to public universities.
But if they said they were Mexican citizens, wouldn't Georgia have accepted them?
The challenge for people like Melissa and Ashley in this sense is that if they were to apply to a public or private university as international students, they couldn't get the same financial aid they'd be able to qualify for if they were considered in-state residents or, for that matter, American citizens.
When did the Georgia Board of Regents institute a policy barring undocumented students from public institutions?
This policy was instituted in 2010.
This is before Donald Trump.
That's right. That's right. This has been the state has had a long and sort of checkered history of anti-immigrant legislation and policies, in this case from the State Board of Regents.
And what reasons were given at the time?
At the time, they said that it was important that the state not open up its public resources to people who weren't paying taxes, which was not true. In fact, undocumented families were paying taxes. They claimed that the undocumented students who were going to public universities were overrunning the system. In fact, that was demonstrably false. But these were the kind of excuses they gave to justify this policy.
It only applied to public institutions.
That's right. And so, you know, there were proposals in the state legislature at the time to ban undocumented students from all public universities. The State Board of Regents interceded and, in what was an attempt at a political compromise, merely said that the top five public universities in the state would be off limits to undocumented students.
What did Errol Davis, the former chancellor of Georgia's university system and superintendent of Atlanta's public schools, say about barring undocumented students?
Well, he made the point that there was a very unsavory historical resonance to this ban on undocumented students.
But he's the one who implemented it in 2010.
And this is one of the slight contradictions, I would say, in his position and in the position of others. I mean, he maintains that he was doing his best to fend off an even harsher measure that was coming through the state legislature. Critics of his would argue that it was up to him to stand up to intimidating state legislators, and that he didn't. He sort of caved.
My guess is Jonathan Blitzer's article, American Studies, which has an online presence under the title An Underground College for Undocumented Immigrants. It's the May 22nd issue of The New Yorker. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You said that her parents Veronica and Victor immigrated to Atlanta from Mexico during the Clinton years.
That's right. It was around the time of the Atlanta Olympics, and so there was a construction boom in the state. They came initially legally. They had work visas, and they renewed those visas every couple of years for close to a decade, a little over a decade.
What happened when they applied for permanent residency?
They eventually applied for permanent residency, and after waiting nearly a year for an official response from the federal government, they're informed with no explanation that that request had been denied.
And who was president at that time? Does it really matter whether it's Bill Clinton or George W. Bush or Barack Obama in the White House?
No. I mean, in this sense, at the time, President Obama was in office. This was a final decision that pretty much made this family undocumented overnight.
Is it common for families to wait years for an answer on their residency applications?
It is. In fact, it's quite overwhelming to hear stories of how long people wait. I mean, the sort of bureaucratic delays are long. The explanations are always sort of vague and unclear. People really are in limbo and kind of in the dark during the process.
Had the twins had problems that involved their undocumented status before they tried to apply for college?
They did, although I'm not always sure that they thought of it that way. They're very resilient, smart kids. For example, they would have situations where it'd be time for them to get a driver's license, and it would be made clear to them that they couldn't do that because they couldn't qualify for a state driver's license.
In some other states, they could have.
That's true. In certain other states, they might have been able to at the time. They kind of assimilated these setbacks, sort of treated them as minor inconveniences, and went about their lives sort of improvising.
Could they have applied for permanent residency on their own?
They couldn't have. I mean, they would have. They applied as a family at the time, and so in 2010, 2011, they were all. Their entire family was in this uncertain situation.
Okay, this brings us to Freedom University. What is it, and how? When and how was it founded?
So, students in Georgia who had graduated from public high schools and who were undocumented immigrants. Who oftentimes grew up in the state of Georgia, found themselves in a bind ever since the State Board of Regents banned them from public universities. They couldn't go to the top five public schools. In addition, there was a state law that had been passed a few years earlier that mandated that undocumented students at the other universities in the state pay out-of-state tuition, which is often two or three times what it costs for in-state residents. They can't apply to private universities because they can't qualify for financial aid. So they're sort of bereft of opportunities to continue their education. And this underground school crops up. It began in the Athens area. And the idea was that this was sort of seen as a parallel to the University of Georgia, which is based there. And a group of professors and students and local activists joined forces to give students who were shut out of the state's education system a chance to continue their educations.
Is it essentially a college without a degree?
That's right. In a certain sense, it is. Now, and it's evolved over the years, now they offer a couple of courses for sort of putative college credit.
Doesn't the state have to okay that?
It's complicated, and they're not accredited. They're not accredited. But I think the priority for the students and faculty at Freedom University, both then and now, is to create a kind of pristine intellectual space where kids can really be educated in a rigorous way and in a way that's modeled after college seminars.
And where are the classes held?
The school has sort of bumped around to different places over the years. At first, it was held in a local community center in Athens. The classes were in these tiny rooms that didn't have air conditioning. Some didn't have windows. They were kind of packed in, but it was always described to me as being a truly electric atmosphere. Everyone was extremely excited to be there.
Wasn't the location kept a secret for a while?
It was. There was
this illegal?
In a certain sense, it was in that because of the legal status of the students who were attending, immigration authorities could always stage raids. That was always a threat. And in fact, the founders of the school frequently received threats by phone, over email, from individuals, sort of local vigilantes, threatening to either storm the school, to raid it. And so as a result, they never disclosed publicly the location of the school and to this day have never done so.
Who are the founders of the school?
So the founders of the school are kind of a broad group of students, local activists, and four professors from the University of Georgia. So there was a group of student activists who were based in the Atlanta area. They were known as the Georgia Undocumented Youth Alliance.
So we're talking about a bunch of 19-year-olds who are creating a university?
That's right. And they had the direction of four, at the time, four humanities professors at the University of Georgia who wanted to lend their help and their services.
And are they the ones who are teaching at Freedom University?
At first they were. And in fact, not only were they themselves teaching classes that ranged from classes on literature to history to semiotics to literary and social theory, but they also often had fellow colleagues from other universities and even writers who would call in sometimes, Skype in to teach their works during class. It was a really dynamic environment.
How did Melissa and Ashley hear about it?
Melissa and Ashley heard about the school through their mother. Their mother had been on Facebook. Veronica is her name. She's an incredibly loving, caring woman who was really broken up about the fact that her daughters were so clearly smart, so clearly motivated, but didn't have a chance to continue their educations. And she saw on someone's Facebook page a mention of Freedom University, and she passed the information along to her daughters, and they sort of gingerly applied at first and ended up going.
And did they have majors?
There isn't a major as such. At the time, the students have say over the curriculum. In the earliest years, the founders largely set the curriculum, but they would come in and take a couple of different classes, and so they'd kind of get a broad-based humanities-type education.
And if they do well, they could probably go to a school in another state, but would they get the credits? Could they transfer credits?
They would never get credits. What they could do is they could get through the sort of concerted lobbying efforts, essentially, of the founders and other teachers who came to visit Freedom University. They could apply to private universities throughout the U.S. and request full financial aid. And in a couple of instances each year, students get full financial aid and make that leap from Freedom University to an accredited four-year college.
My guest is Jonathan Blitzer. His article, American Studies, is in the May 22nd issue of The New Yorker. You can find it online under An Underground College for Undocumented Immigrants. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Jonathan Blitzer. His article, American Studies, was in the May 22nd issue of The New Yorker. You can find it online under An Underground College for Undocumented Immigrants. Is this a full-time program? How often would they meet a week?
The classes are once a week on Sundays for several hours, from sort of late morning to late afternoon.
And most of the teachers are university professors who are volunteering?
That's right. That's right. And sometimes they even commute quite a ways just to participate in this school.
We talked about how the family waited a long time for a response to their residency application. What happened when it was finally denied by the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service?
Well, the family sort of huddled up in the living room after they got this terrible news and tried to plot a course forward. The girls were still in high school, so they decided to at least wait long enough for the two girls to finish high school. While they were waiting, they received in the mail a notice that was essentially a deportation order for the twins' sister.
Melanie, their older sister.
That's right. That's right. And that notice indicated that she had until June 15th, 2012, to leave the country. And again, it really caught them off guard, threw them off, because it was only a notice for her, for Melanie, not for the rest of the family. So they decided to sort of bide their time and see how it played out. And then to their tremendous relief, on June 15th, 2012, President Obama issued an executive order that essentially gave this family, their children, reprieve under a program called DACA.
Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. But what did it mean for their parents?
It actually didn't resolve the legal limbo that their parents remained in, but it did give cover to the daughters, who no longer had to fear deportation and, in fact, who qualified finally for driver's licenses, for work permits, and so on, and so could begin to have a more normal life in the state.
Has that been revoked?
It's not been revoked as such, and there's a lot of anxiety about what the new president is doing with regard to DACA. He's said publicly that he doesn't want to revoke it, even though on the campaign trail he promised to revoke all of President Obama's executive orders. But there are concerns, all of them extremely well-founded, I'm afraid, that the current administration is effectively dismantling the protections afforded by DACA through other means.
Did you speak a lot with the twins' mother, Veronica?
I did. Their mother has a really interesting attitude about what she's been through in the state.
What did she say she hoped that her children would gain from going to classes at Freedom University?
She wanted them to be able to push themselves intellectually, to expand themselves personally. It was very important to her that her kids had a better opportunity than she had herself. So she hadn't gone to college, and it was important that her daughters, who were high-achieving high school students, had some chance at what would in effect be kind of higher education. So she was a big champion of theirs and remains a big champion of theirs.
But how does the school function? Obviously, it needs money for supplies. It has to find space to teach in. We talked about getting faculty. Is that an ongoing problem for them?
Early on, they relied entirely on donations and on volunteers. There was one organization, a local organization in Athens, that offered its services. It was called the Economic Justice Coalition, and they offered money, support, their nonprofit status to be a clearinghouse for donations, things like that.
And that's where Linda Lloyd got involved?
That's right. That's right.
She was an activist who was fighting for voter registration rights and wage increases for African Americans. So did she see the Economic Justice Coalition as also being an appropriate for dealing with undocumented immigrants as well?
This was one of the surprises for me in doing this story, was hearing how people like Linda Lloyd, long-time activists who've really done incredible work over the years, recognize the parallels.
That's right.
In an entirely different area, but recognize the parallels between the black experience in the South facing various forms of discrimination, institutionalized and not, and now the discrimination faced by undocumented families.
And then there were just simple problems, like why was it important to establish a rideshare and shuttle system for the students?
Well, this was, at first, the major logistical challenge facing the school. Basically, at the time, federal law allowed local law enforcement to arrest individuals for minor things like traffic infractions and then in turn process them for deportation. And so a big concern among the faculty was, at the time, the students didn't have driver's licenses, so technically they would all be driving without licenses. And so they didn't want to endanger anyone's immigration status by forcing them to drive to school. So they created essentially a vast carpool system.
How many undocumented students are we talking about in Georgia?
Well, The numbers vary. I mean, Georgia has the second largest population of undocumented immigrants in the South after Florida. So they've got around 350,000 undocumented individuals in the state. And then in terms of students, I think probably the best number I've seen is that roughly 3,000 students graduate each year from public schools in the state, and they are undocumented, even though they've grown up in the state of Georgia.
I understand Florida, because it's also been a magnet for Cubans, so there's a lot of Spanish speakers in the state. But why Georgia?
You know, it's a question that I've always had myself. I think some of it is somewhat ad hoc. It has to do with the labor market. So there are farming opportunities in the southern part of the state. There are construction and development opportunities in the northern part of the state. I know Victor and Veronica, for instance, first came because they had a family member who had come, and that family member had in turn heard from a fellow resident in a community in Mexico that there were good job opportunities in the Atlanta area in the mid-90s, and so it sort of grew over the years. But it's a major population in the South, and one that's often overlooked.
And it's interesting that we're talking about Georgia, a state that resisted integration way past Brown versus Board of Education.
That's right. And that historical parallel was lost on no one. And so the very schools that were banning undocumented students were the schools that resisted integration. So the University of Georgia didn't integrate until 1961. And so it was always very striking to the students at Freedom University that, you know, the struggle that they faced was one that had historical antecedents.
What happened in Prince Edward County, Virginia in 1959 that applies here?
Well, basically, in Prince Edward County, Virginia, in 1959, the local school board refused to agree to the order to integrate the schools, the public schools. And so what they did was shut down all public schools in the area at the time. And so black students who wanted to continue their educations had to find a way to sort of improvise in the meantime. And a network of so-called freedom schools sprung up. And there was a history of this kind of educational environment in the South. It had a lot to do with the civil rights movement and civil rights organizing. But basically, individuals would gather in stores and backyards and church basements, and they would pursue an academic curriculum of their own so that they could study while the public schools were closed.
We mentioned that Freedom University worried about the fact that it might be illegal. Wouldn't these places also have been worried about something similar?
Yeah, it took tremendous courage for individuals throughout the South to organize in freedom schools. Oftentimes, they would be suspended from their local public schools if authorities ever found out that they had been secretly attending these freedom schools. So it was very much a clandestine operation, but something that they felt very, very passionately about.
And all over, you write about the nonviolent high in Macomb, Mississippi.
That's right. In the early 60s, an organizer by the name of Charlie Cobb, who was with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, basically saw a tradition of these freedom schools in the South and tried to wed that pedagogical tradition, that academic tradition, with civil rights organizing. And so throughout Mississippi, you had by 1964 close to 40 freedom schools that operated in the state, and that kind of doubled as opportunities too for young black students to begin leadership training so that they could become active as civil rights activists.
But when the public schools were integrated throughout the South, weren't they mostly African Americans, because whites were going to charter schools or the equivalent?
That's true, and the academic landscape changed somewhat. That said, schools where young black students were matriculating often rarely received funds that would be sufficient for their continued operation, and so there are all kinds of truly staggering and frankly appalling statistics about, you know, the percentage of the student population in a state like Mississippi that was black that received a disproportionately small amount of educational resources from the state.
Is that still true?
That's still true to an extent. I certainly am not an expert anymore in exactly how state resources are appropriated for public education, particularly in the South. But I imagine that legacy very much continues.
Although it's been pointed out that New York City has some of the most segregated schools of any major city in the United States, simply because of neighborhoods, the way neighborhoods have been formed.
That's absolutely true. And in fact, freedom schools, I've always associated freedom schools, and I think many other people do, with the South and with sort of active resistance to institutionalized racism in the South. But there have been moments in history when freedom schools and that model have been adopted as far north as New York City and even as far sort of west as Chicago.
Now, there were protests at the Freedom University, and Melissa and Ashley eventually joined them. Had they resisted for a while out of fear that something bad might happen?
Yeah, at first, the students at Freedom University would go to class on Sundays, and then they would also plan these actions, attempts to raise consciousness about the state policy and how unjust it was. The twins were scared about going at first. They were reticent because they didn't yet have that protection from DACA, and as a result, risked being arrested and potentially processed for deportation if they ever sort of wound up on the wrong side of things.
And it was a legitimate fear. We've just seen a Texas House of Representatives member just called ICE because people were protesting outside of his office.
Yep, and that, I mean, there are so many examples of exactly these kinds of threats and this kind of behavior. It's truly disheartening. There was a similar example in Mississippi several months ago, a young woman who was speaking out about the deportation of her father and who, after a rally at which she spoke, was followed by immigration agents and arrested. It's a reality.
What kinds of protests have we seen from as a result of Freedom University, which likes to call itself FU?
That's
right. I guess we won't explain that joke.
Yeah, they have on their T-shirts, FU Georgia, Freedom University, Georgia. The actions that were organized by students at Freedom University were always very pointed. So, for example, in the winter of 2015, an action that both Ashley and Melissa were involved in was a sort of forced integration of a classroom, a symbolic integration of a classroom at the University of Georgia.
They had a sit-in?
That's right. They had a sit-in. There were about 70 or 80 people who turned out, some of whom were major historical personages who wanted to lend their name and their direction to this effort. And that particular sit-in resulted in Melissa's arrest at the time.
And then could she have been deported?
That was a danger. To the credit of the directors of the school, both the founders and the current director, Amico Sotis, the students are given training in how to protest in ways that allow them to exercise their rights to civil disobedience, but that are also sort of mindful and conscientious about some of the legal risks of going too far.
What are Melissa and Ashley doing now?
Well, their paths at this particular moment in time have, for the first time in their lives, begun to diverge. So Ashley, this past year, in the fall of 2016, after years of applying to colleges, both of them applied together, would often get into different places, again, have distinguished academic records, but could never get full funding to go. Finally, Ashley managed to get into Emory University on a full ride. She started in the fall and has just finished her freshman year.
What's she studying?
At this point, she's not entirely sure. She's taking kind of a range of classes. I don't think the electoral climate, the political climate, particularly inclined her toward political subjects. So she took a film class, she took a sociology class, she took a Portuguese class, and she was kind of just enjoying for a time having the chance to sort of drink deep of the humanities well at Emory.
What about their parents and their older sister?
They continue to live now more than ever in a state of precariousness and uncertainty and concern. I mean, the election of Donald Trump has really marked a major shift in their lives, and they're very much sort of having to look out for themselves and are concerned about really any chance run-in with local immigration officials.
So Ashley is at Emory. What is Melissa doing?
So Melissa also applied to a couple of schools over the last few years, but this year could not matriculate because she didn't get both admitted and the full financial aid she needed. And so she's in kind of an uncertain spot. She's a very talented artist. She's begun to do some of her own artwork and has started to sell some of it online and works various odd jobs. She worked at a local theme park. But for the first time, you actually see the two of them beginning down different paths.
Did they talk to you about their concerns about the current political climate?
They did. And you know, these are very fierce young women who are, very assertive and I would argue fearless. But the current climate is something that's far more hostile than anything that they've necessarily seen before. They would argue that it had been bad even in years past, including under Obama as well.
Called the deporter in chief.
That's right. And for good reason. I think the standards, though, for how immigration officials worked under Obama were kind of more fleshed out. And so now, in addition to the usual fear, there's really a sense of uncertainty.
You can find Jonathan Blitzer's American Studies in the May 22nd issue of The New Yorker. We have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for being on our show again.